Welcome to Nature Now, an original production by KPTZ Volunteers. Nature Now is a program of information and insights about the natural history of our region. We welcome observations and suggestions from our listeners. Care of Nature Now at kptz.org.
Hello, this is Deborah Kelso, host of this edition of Nature Now for the first week of January 2019. This week, we are very pleased to have as the core of our program an encore presentation of an interview that we did almost exactly a year ago with our guests Francis Wood and Govinda Rosling, who were here to tell us about their work with the Pidgeon-Guillemot Research Group on Whidbey Island. And I'm also very pleased to have Nora Petrich here helping with events and observations, and also she's our grand sound editor and recording specialist today.
Hi.
But before we get to our main topic, let's first hear the mystery sound of the week. Isn't this an interesting call? We'll play it again at the end of the program and tell you what it is. First of all, we'd like to wish you all a very happy new year. And it is the perfect time of year to remind you of a sweet tradition amongst those of us that love birds, the bird of the year. The first bird that you encounter on the first day of the year becomes your totem bird for that year. And throughout the year, you focus on learning as much as you can about that bird, its habits, calls, life cycle, etc. Since this program is being recorded about 10 days early due to all of the holidays, I cannot tell you yet what my bird of the year is, but I always look forward to the tradition. And it's not too late to start yourselves. The morning after you hear this program, go outside and open your eyes and ears to the winged life surrounding you.
Speaking of winged life, as many of you know, the figures from the Audubon Society's 119th annual Christmas bird count are just starting to roll in from various counts held on the Olympic Peninsula over the past couple of weeks. The weather was unfortunately very stormy, so it was difficult to get a good count, but we will look forward to sharing the news with you in a week or so.
Forrest Schomer relayed that he has been seeing some amazing slime molds in his compost bin of late. This particular slime mold that Forrest has been seeing goes by an unforgettable name, as if slime mold was not bad enough. This one is called the dog vomit or scrambled egg slime mold. And it's so named for its bright yellow color and the odd curdled texture of the fruiting bodies. It's most likely to show up during warm, wet periods, sometimes seeming to pop out of nowhere overnight, especially after a heavy rain. It's most often found in moist, shady areas and on materials such as mulch, rotting logs, leaf litter, and untreated lumber, and sometimes on lawn grass. And actually, there's this really bizarre aside that back in 1973, there was a woman in Texas that phoned the authorities when she saw this giant slime mold on her yard. There was some thought that it was an alien invasion. I mean, the slime molds are really quite extraordinary. There's saprophytic, meaning that they feed on decaying organic materials and they have worldwide distribution. They originally were thought to be a fungus. It's now known that slime mold organisms predate fungi on the evolutionary ladder and are a separate kingdom called Protistus. There are over 500 species of slime molds.
This is starting to sound like a Halloween issue.
I know,
Nature Now.
I know it is.
Meanwhile, Fred Sharp has been observing acorns sprouting from the Good Gary Oak acorn crop this year in the Squim area. Also called Oregon White Oak, it is the only oak tree native to Washington and British Columbia, and it was used by several tribes in the Puget Sound area for food, along with wood being highly prized by coopers for making barrels. The Clallam ate the acorns as a nut without any preparation, but in small enough quantity that they were not bothered by the tannin content of the nut. The Salish people soak the acorns before eating them in order to leach out the bitter tannins. The bark of gary oak was one of four ingredients in the Saanich people's four barks medicine used against tuberculosis and other ailments. Fred has also noted that the mild autumn has provided a bounty of fresh miner's lettuce for your New Year's salad.
Yum! Well, I've always loved pigeon guillemots, but I didn't realize until recently that there's been a research group studying them for over a decade right across the water from us. So we're so pleased to have two members of their group, Francis Wood and Govinda Rosling, join us to speak about their research today. Francis Wood is a writer, artist, and naturalist, and was co-creator and writer for Bird Note, one of our very favorite radio programs, and it was indeed a major inspiration for this radio show. And Francis was also instrumental in starting the Pigeon Guillemot Research Group about 12 years ago over on Whidbey Island. And Govinda Rosling grew up on Whidbey Island and has been involved with the Guillemot Research Group for the last 7 years. Govinda also coordinates the South Whidbey Christmas Bird Count, and we'll talk about that a little bit towards the end of our program. Welcome to Nature Now, Francis and Govinda. Perhaps we should start by describing what pigeon guillemots are for those in our radio audience not familiar with these delightful seabirds.
Yes, this is Francis, and they are delightful seabirds. Pigeon guillemots are really marine birds, but if you can imagine a chunky little bird, mainly black with bright fire engine red legs and feet, and they have a white splash on their wings. They're probably called pigeon guillemots because maybe at first glance they look like a pigeon sitting out on the sea somewhere.
But
they
do have so much more elegant than a pigeon.
They do have kind of a small head, so maybe that's how they got their name. So pigeon guillemots are part of the Alcid family. Also in that family are the puffins. You probably are familiar with that bird, and also murres and murrelets. These are strong swimmers, and they are really designed for swimming underwater to catch their prey. They spend most of their life out in the water and mainly come on shore just for the breeding season.
They also have really specialized bills. The puffins, people know those really heavy bills that are meant to carry a bunch of fish, but the guillemots have that wild, bright red inside their mouths. Looking from the outside, it's a long, strong, dark bill meant to carry like one fish at a time, right?
Yeah, so these are just straight pointed beaks as opposed to that very wide flattened beak of, say, the puffin. They have different feeding strategies, thus the different shapes of beaks. The guillemots will pick up one prey. We watch them as they deliver these prey to their young, and there's always just one prey in their mouth. Whereas if you haven't seen a puffin, you've probably seen pictures of them, that very colorful dandy of a bird with multiple little fish in its mouth kind of drooping over the lower beak. They have an amazing way of being able to hold one fish in the back of their mouth and be able to catch another fish and then hold it in the back of the mouth and move forward.
It's all tied together, which is so cool. The more you read, the more you understand things and how they then can carry prey from farther away, right? The pigeon guillemots tend to feed closer to their nest sites, while the puffins will carry prey, a whole stack of prey from a longer distance away, right? There's so many things to talk about. We're like into fish now, but back to their what they look like. They're unmistakable in their breeding plumage, but they can be confusing to identify at times in the winter due to their radical change in coloration, right?
This is Govinda here, and yes, they are in that winter plumage from, say, October to February, and in the breeding plumage, as Francis mentioned, it was blackbird with that white splash and the black wedge in there of that wing patch. In the wintertime, they're really more white-colored, a little more dusky. They still have the red feet, if you can see them, but they will always have that little black wedge in that white wing patch, but they do look very different in the winter. And then come February, as they're molting into that breeding plumage, then they get like maybe the pigeony look to them. They get all speckled. Uh-huh. And you can see that over on the other side of the water at Keystone is sort of a build bird up site that we do see a lot in the early spring or late winter of these like speckled pigeon guillemots as they're changing to that breeding plumage.
Oh, cool. And the sexes are identical in both breeding and non-breeding plumage, right?
Yes, absolutely. Yeah. You don't know which is which until you see them mate.
What about the juveniles? They can be confusing too, right? They sometimes look like adults in their non-breeding plumage.
Yes. The juveniles, I would say, maybe are a little more brown and dusky after they fledge and they're just kind of palling around in the water. In the wintertime, I would say they're just a little bit, maybe a little darker around the eye and maybe a little more dusky.
Their wing patch is not necessarily as defined as the adults. But you can still, if you look carefully, it's there. It's just kind of shadowed with more of a speckled or salt and pepper kind of look to it.
But by the time the breeding season comes along, the juveniles will be in breeding plumage.
Yes, uh-huh. Right. So the next spring, they all look, again, pretty much solid uh-huh. black.
What about their life cycle? Do they breed at certain periods of time? And then what do they do in the wintertime?
These are what I would call marine birds. They spend their life on the water. They are sleeping on the water, diving down, catching their food underwater, and hanging out on the water in good feeding areas until around April or May when they return to their breeding colonies. And they then congregate near the base of high bluffs and hang out there in their breeding colonies and go through their breeding cycles through the summer until around August, September, when they all start leaving. As the young fledge, they all will leave the breeding areas and then again disperse out into marine waters. We do not ban the birds that we watch on Whidbey Island, so we don't know where they go. But from the literature that we've read, we understand that they will go to good feeding areas and spend the rest of the year there.
But not too far offshore. They're considered right. near shore marine birds.
Right.
And the term pelagic is always a little confusing. They're not true pelagic birds.
Well, I think of pelagic birds as like the shearwaters that really stay way offshore and would go to nest on remote islands and so forth, whereas I think of these more as marine birds since we do see them for several months right here on the shores of the Salish Sea in large numbers.
They don't dive deep the way like murres will. That they feed on the bottom, but not deep bottom, right?
Exactly. They're eating mainly what we find in our study, at least what they're delivering to their young, are the gunnels and the sculpins, which are benthic fish, not in very deep water, like you mentioned.
Uh-huh. Yeah. How did you get started with the study, and how long has it been going on?
About 13 years ago, I had been doing the breeding bird survey for Seattle Audubon, and that had finished up, and I had loved that research that I had been doing with them, and I was quite interested in having found various colonies of guillemots around Whidbey Island. And so I went into our Audubon meeting one day and asked if anyone would be interested in joining me and studying these birds. And I got some volunteers that day, and then from there it's just increased over the years. So we now have about 1,000 birds that we study around Whidbey Island, and they break up into about 26 colonies. So it's been a really a fun project, citizen science project, that has involved a lot of volunteers and scientific research. And we've now actually mentored other groups to start projects in other parts of the Salish Sea.
So what's the main objective of your study?
Govinda here. Basically, we want to collect the breeding success of pigeon guillemots. We want to find out what they're choosing to feed their chicks, looking at how many guillemots are out in the water, so the population, how many burrows they're occupying, and how often they're feeding these fish types to their chicks. And another objective is really to have this ongoing and long-term study continuing year after year so we know what normal is. We can have this baseline of data and really to have just eyes on the beach. So if or when a disaster may occur, we can act a lot more quickly.
people forget how important it is to have baseline information. I mean, I think that that's one of the main objectives of the University of Washington Coast program, too. While they're documenting dead birds, you're getting a baseline of what's normal. Otherwise, you don't have anything to compare it to when disaster strikes.
Absolutely.
And I was reading that pigeon guillemots are particularly susceptible to oil spills, too, because they're feeding in the nearshore environment.
Yeah, they are very susceptible to changes that may happen in the water column, whether it be oil spills or maybe other toxins. So for us to look at the guillemots, we know that if their numbers start to go down, then there may be a larger problem at bay.
Why are pigeon guillemots such an important species for us to monitor in our area?
The $20,000 question.
I know. People always want to know, well, why should I volunteer for that project? Or why should I donate money to that one versus any other one?
Yeah, we look at pigeon guillemots. For one, they are the only seabird that commonly nests throughout the Salish Sea. There's a lot of them. They're easy to spot. This is an observational study. So like Francis said, we're not banding them. We're just watching them with a pair of binoculars. So it's an easy thing that we can collect data on year after year. They are a key indicator of the health of the Salish Sea. So for one, they're easy to find. And two, they can tell us a lot about the health of the nearshore environment.
And there really aren't other seabirds. So this is a category, I'm not talking about gulls here or ducks, but seabirds that breed in the Salish Sea. So it is a very common bird that we can track.
And they're easy to see. They're close. For people that aren't going out to survey in a boat, you can survey from the coast, right? And
right.
Get an idea of what's going on instead of having to make a major survey effort to go offshore to locate them. We have a couple of upcoming natural history events to tell you about. The Olympic Peninsula Audubon chapter up in Squim is starting their new year off right with a new class in their backyard birder program titled Birdscaping, Inviting Birds to Your Yard. It takes place on Saturday, January 5th from 10 a.m. to noon up at the Dungeness River Audubon Center in Squim. Go to their website at olympicpeninsulaaudubon.org for more information.
Then on Tuesday, January 8th, join the Jefferson Land Trust for a tour of their new Maristone Island Preserve from 10 a.m. to 1 p.m. They only secured funding to buy this beautiful property at the end of October of last year, so there is still much work to be done that they would love your help with. Go to saveland.org for more information.
Here's our mystery sound again. That sound is a pigeon guillemot. So, Frances and Govinda, I'll leave it to you to talk about the mystery sound.
This is Frances. That's such a wonderful sound, that trilling noise. We hear a lot of this when we're studying the birds. We often hear them on the water singing back and forth to each other. But also what's very fun is if perhaps one of the birds will be in the burrow incubating. And while sitting on the beach, you can hear them calling from the burrow and then also hearing some kind of a response happening out on the water. So particularly given that many seabirds have just a very grunting sound, a very non-melodic noise, these guillemots have such a really a very pleasant sound. It's so much fun to hear their trilling, their vocalizations.
So do they vocalize during the wintertime too, or is it mostly during the breeding season?
This is Govinda here, and I'm just trying to think about that. I don't think so. In the summertime, they are really congregating and as colonial nesters, so there's a lot of them around. In the winter, you might just have maybe one or two. We saw a few on the ferry ride over here, but they weren't really talking much to each other.
Right, that socialization comes with the breeding period in the spring and then through the summer, which is not to say you might hear a couple of them talking in the winter, but it's not anywhere near as obvious.
We have run out of time for today. We're going to have to come back to part two next month. Thanks so much for joining us.
Thanks for having us.
Yes, it's been a pleasure. Thank you.
Well, we're happy to have you. And that's it for KPTC's Nature Now for the first week of January. Thanks very much for joining me, Nora, and thanks to all of you for listening. Remember, if you missed any of our program or want to listen again, this program will be rebroadcast at 5 p.m. on Thursday, 12:30 on Saturday, and available as a podcast in a week or so at kptz.org. And as always,
happy trails!
That's my sister Nancy joining in the chorus.
Closing music is Fleet from the group Guillemot. Windows, path, yeah, domino, excuse me, somebody hold me until you know.